Good morning to everybody. Welcome. Good to see you. And there's a wonderful Yiddish expression, Eider if will on he mered and lomazugna purverter. It says, before I start speaking, let me say a few words. It's sort of fitting for this. You know, when I do prepare for these talks, I try, you know, basically being a rabbi is sort of an occupational hazard. And that occupational hazard is that ultimately I'm making a Dvar Torah, trying to do something like a sermon. And I try to avoid that in this with us, because ultimately that's not what we're here for. It's we use the Parsha as a way to locate ourselves in the world. That's sort of like our calendar. When we talk about a Parsha, we know we're reading something that is being read by Jews all over the world. And there's a certain kind of comfort in that these stories are what still unite us, and etc. Now, this portion, of course, has all the portions, but this is quite a dramatic one. It follows an interruption in our narrative from the giving of the Torah, which, by the way, I understand now was given orally. Moses does not come down on that first event with the tablets, and it's basically spoken. So, if I could use a modern expression, the Torah, the ten sayings are not yet written in stone. Okay, that's why some people often joke they're not really 10 commandments; they're only 10 suggestions. And then Moses goes up in the mountain, etc. And this Porsche is rich in so many dramatic events and teachings. It talks about the census of the Israelites, the instructions for the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle. The golden calf incident, and then the renewal of the covenant between God and Israel, and many other small things. So let me begin. There are a number of things I'd like to emphasize for today that may be helpful in our practice, and that's what I'm always trying to look for. What can be helpful in our practice? I always urge you to go to the various sources we have online, literally hundreds, if not more, of interpretations and comments on the Parsha, and many of them are quite illustrative, and some of them contradictory, but that's part of our tradition as well. So now I'll begin the talk. So the portion begins with God instructing Moshe to take a census of the Israelites, and with each person contributing a half shekel, a half weight. Shekel means weight, by the way, and of course it later on became the name for a currency, right? But half shekel means the half of a weight, as a ransom for their souls. And this money was to be used as a service of the tabernacle. And it was a way also of creating a census without necessarily having to count people. And I won't get involved in that, with the issue of counting and why we use the shekel instead. And this portion then outlines further instructions for the construction of the Mishkan, including the making of the bronze laver and beating of anointing oil, of incense, etc. And then it gives us the names of the people who were involved in the building of the Mishkan that we received in the last 2 weeks before this, Bezalel and Ohilaav, the two chief artisans, and they're filled with, according to the text, with divine wisdom, with understanding and skill. I think that's really a wonderful way of seeing our lives, too, just for a moment as an aside. We have to have the wisdom, basically. What is it we want to do? It could be a vision, in a way. But then we have to understand what it is we want to do. And then, of course, then comes the hard part of doing what we want to do. How do we do it skillfully? That's a nice word, to do things with skill. And the importance of observing the Shabbat, then, is brought in, is again. And here it's done in the context of the building of the Mishkan. And this is, again, not for today, but the establishment of the rules of what is prohibited on Shabbat. There are 39 categories of what is not permitted on Shabbat are derived by the many things that were done in the building of the Mishkan. So that's the connection there. And then it moves dramatically to the incident of the golden calf. And you know the story, you've seen the film, we have the book, right? So while Moses is on Mount Sinai receiving the tablets of the law, the Israelites, fearing that Moshe will not return, persuade Aaron to make a molten calf. The people declare the calf to be their god. And that's also debated in the commentaries. Are they looking to replace God, or are they looking to replace Moses? Moses. And they then engage in all of this revelry and worship and dance and offering their emotions over to this, surrounding this calf. And Moshe then is informed of this, which is kind of interesting. Moshe shatters the tablets, as we know, and tries to quell this, as one scholar of the Exodus says, this counter-revolution, that this is not an uncommon thing when you have the revolution of leaving Egypt. The discussion of the manifesto of that event, and then you get the counter-revolution. We saw this in many revolutions in the past. And Moshe quells it, and he says, "Who is with me?" And of course, his only people who come to support him are his own clan, the clan of Levi, they do. Everybody gets startled by this, but he does execute the people who were the, if you will, the instigators of the counter-revolution. And Moshe then takes the calf. It's a very weird thing in a way. Takes the calf and has it ground down, which is kind of interesting because how you do it if it's gold, but still. And then he puts it in the water and everybody has to drink it. The joke that I often tell is the first caffeinated drink that we have. But we have another way of seeing this drinking in the episode of the Sota, the woman who was accused by her husband of adultery. And there's a ceremony of drinking this potion with the name of God in it. And of course, this was a way to assuage the jealous husband. And in many, very few cases do we hear that the ceremony really, really result in any damage to the woman. So the next part of it, of course, is this pleading by Moses, by Moshe, to grant forgiveness for the people, because God says, okay, I am going to leave the scene now, and these people will be destroyed. And Moshe says, you know, before you do that, there are so many other things you can do. Take me out of the book, he even says. It's interesting. Take me out of the book. I will, you know, just erase me from all this rather than erase them. He's given the attributes of mercy that we use on Yom Kippur, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'chanun, Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed. We use that all the time as our sort of vehicle for tshuva, for return. And then Moses is told to carve two new tablets. This time the tablets are not provided. He has to bring his own stationery. It must have been hard carrying it up the mountain. But these tablets are not large, by the way. The measurements of them are reasonable. God inscribes the Ten Commandments again, symbolizing the renewal of the covenant. And then the portion concludes with the renewal of the covenant, and Moshe has returned to the people with new tablets, and something has happened to Moshe. His face begins to shine, a radiance, from his encounter, so much that he must wear a veil when speaking to the people, which is kind of an interesting idea of what is revealed and what is hidden, right? And the Zohar, the mystical tradition, which I went into to try to help us find a connection to our practice, focuses on a few things. It focuses on, one, the spiritual implications of the senses, the half shekel. And I say they do it in a very beautiful way. And they say the half shekel, the Zohar says, half shekel offering, first of all, gives everybody a sense of ownership, first of all. Everybody, no matter whether rich or poor, gives the same amount, this half shekel, a fairly negligible amount, affordable by most people. They create ownership. Everyone has access now to the Mishkan. They're all supporting it. But also the Zohar has a beautiful way of saying it. It says the half shekel offering represents the concept that each soul is only part of a greater whole, that we are all, in a sense, not totally complete without being in contact or in spiritual community. And real spiritual protection comes from unity. So part of how we make our half whole is by community. And by contributing to the Mishkan, each person becomes part of that divine service, and the community as a whole is shielded from judgment. So the half shekel is a reminder that we are all connected, and that our spiritual well-being is intertwined with that of the entire people. So this idea of communal responsibility, I think, is something that it's hard to necessarily put into practice, but the issue becomes in our individual sits, in our individual, if you will, meditative practice. Does this, in a sense, obviate our need to be in contact with others? That's why I'm so glad we gather together as our little sangha, our little community every week. And then the Zohar delves into the sin of the golden calf, of course, which is this great example of idolatry, and we can talk about idolatry at a separate time, but for my sake, the way I've come to understand idolatry is anytime you worship the fragment rather than the whole, whole, the whole, and by thinking that the fragment represents what really is, but there is a larger whole, which is often, interrupted by our concentrating on the fragment. So you can worship trees, you worship stars, and Abraham supposedly gave us the idea that no, you have to look at the larger picture of the universe, how everything fits in, and eventually to the source of the universe, which Jews have seen as being God. And also, it talks about this profound spiritual fall, right? It's 40 days after they are told about the 10 sayings on Mount Sinai, they get involved in this. So it's seen as a profound spiritual fall. In a sense, if there is anything like original sin in Judaism, it's probably this event of disruption of the connection between the Israelites and the divine. So the creation of the calf is seen as an attempt to replaced the direct connection with God, at least in the Zohar, with physical, idolatrous form, and it reflects a fear and lack of faith. And the Zohar says the sin of the golden calf was not just a betrayal of the covenant, but a severance of that spiritual connection. It's called in Hebrew the perud, a disruption of connection, the perud, separation. By turning to a physical idol, the Israelites, the Zohar tells us, sought to anchor their faith in something tangible. Yet this led to a spiritual descent. Some say, I'm now not quoting the Zohar, but some say the idea of introducing the building of the Mishkan before this parsha, even though it's probably out of context, is to say that, yes, there is an understanding about our need to invest ourselves in something tangible. And then we learn the great thing about the power of tshuva, of repentance, or return, or recalibration, however you want it. I also play, this is not the Zohar, but tshuva also in modern Hebrew means an answer. It's an answer. You ask a sheila, and you receive a tshuva, an answer. And it's kind of interesting. The way we would translate it would be a reply, rather than, a reply. And in this reply to the question is the first question asked by God in the Garden of Eden, where are you? Ayeka, simple question, but yet a very difficult one to answer. And have to answer it in different ways throughout our lives. So tshuva can restore even the most broken connections. Moses intercedes. The renewal of the covenant demonstrates, the Zohar tells us, the infinite capacity of divine mercy and the ability of Israel to return to the spiritual path. And the third thing, I'm not going to go into more than that, about the radiance of Moses' face, the transmission of divine light. And of course, the Zohar reflects on this radiant light that emanates from Moshe's face after his encounter with God, interpreting as a symbol of divine wisdom and the light that Moshe received and transmitted to the people. And the veil that Moses wears signifies the hidden and reveal aspects of this divine wisdom. The Zohar says, the radiance of Moses' face was an outward manifestation of the divine light and wisdom that he absorbed in the presence of the Holy One. Blessed be he. And this light was too intense for the people to bear directly, so Moses covered his face with a veil. The veil represents the hidden dimensions of Torah, the esoteric teachings that are revealed only to those who are spiritually prepared to receive them. And through Moses, the divine light is transmitted to Israel, illumining their path with the wisdom of Torah. And of course, part of that renewal of the covenant is the giving us the attributes, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'Chanun. Zohar tells us that God revealed these 13 attributes of mercy to Moses. He provided the key to divine forgiveness and enduring covenant. Now, these attributes are the channels through which divine mercy flows into the world, allowing for the rectification of sins and the renewal of the spiritual bond between God and God's people. The renewal of the covenant after the sin of the golden calf is a testament to the power of these attributes, which sustain the relationship between the Creator and the created. And we can go on to many different Kabbalistic interpretations of this. And there's one thing that I did not mention, which I didn't know how to get into. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about it. And that is Moshe, as part of this tshuva process, is at a place of a bit of desperation. He says, you know, we're dealing with a very stiff-necked people here. And God repeats that. Yes, they are a stiff-necked people, and I'll get rid of them. And Moshe says, as I say, you can erase me from your book. But then he says something really unique. Show me your face, he says. Show me your face. Hareni et kvotcha. Show me your glory. And God says, nobody sees God, sees me, and lives. And that leads me to think about whether or not Moshe is requesting to be extinguished into the divine. Is he reached a point now where he wants to leave necessarily this earthly existence, and he wants to die, at least die spiritually, if not physically? And God says, no, that can't be done. He puts him in the cleft of the mountain on Sinai, and he passes over, however that means, it's a very anthropomorphic description of God, passes over, and all that Moshe can see is what's happened, not what is happening. And this is something that we all know, is that you don't really know what happened until it's over. That's why we study history, right? It's over. We can at least attempt to try to understand what happened after it's over. We can talk about that as well. There's a lot to talk about, obviously. So I tried to cull it down to this. So I think the essential thing for me and how it works in our practice is that we have the power to return. And I think the breathing in and out is an example of that. Give out, we take in, we give out, we take in. We have that capacity to return to our neshima, to our breath. If you want, return to our soul, return to our core. I think that's a nice way of saying it. Our core identity, our core existence, which is ultimately being a creature in the larger creation that it basically breathes, that has the capacity to live, but also, of course, will decay and die. So I said a lot of words before I started talking, and then I started talking and said a lot of words after that. So I hope it wasn't too overwhelming, but it's just a very, by the way, I know Reggie used to read this parsha for many years. Right, Reggie? Right? That was one of your things that you did for many, many years. So you all know the story. A lot of people don't know really, but have not read the text. That's why I recommend you read the text itself. That's chapter 33 is the most complicated one. The entire parsha is really four chapters, but that one, chapter 33 in Shemot and Exodus, really has evoked literally thousands of comments over the years, because it is something that's hard to really, really comprehend. It, maybe it's not meant to be comprehended intellectually. Maybe that's it. That's the problem. We try to understand this, quote unquote, intellectually in our terms. It's interesting. When we use our intellect, it's a process of interpretation, right? Our intellect wants to absorb it. And of course, what shapes our response is our own desire to have things have form, our desire to have things have an understandable context, and somehow make it, and this is what reason is supposed to be, intellect and reason, we want to make it reasonable, etc. But as some of you may know, things aren't always reasonable, despite all of our efforts. So I'm sorry I spoke so long, but we have some time for responses, so I look forward to hearing from you. Let me shut